If I may, Your Honor, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Nelson Berry. I represent Mr. Abdel Ouahid. The issue before the court today is whether, in the context of a declaratory judgment proceeding, the lower court erred after declaring as a matter of law that none of the statutory exceptions to the Homestead Exemption Act alleged by the plaintiff applied, in sua sponte, imposing a constructive trust, which no one had asked for, upon funds that were protected by the Homestead Exemption to satisfy a judgment in favor of the plaintiff obtained on funds that my client failed to transfer her as a result of an award in a dissolution proceeding. The short answer to that question is, yes, the lower court erred. It can't do that. And before I delve into that argument, I did want to correct the record, if I may, about misstatements that both counsel have made with respect to the Fidelity investment account. Contrary to the assertion by Ms. Gass, that account was not awarded to Ms. Gass. Rather, she was awarded $107,787 from that account. Yes, and why do we know that? Is because at Clerk's Paper 55, the arbitrator stated that he had used an old value for that account because the, quote, significant increase since then is considered Mr. Abdel Wahid's separate property. And we know that also because as late as November of 2011, 6 months after the decree was entered, when Mr. Wahid took out $109,000 from that account, there were still sufficient funds in that account to pay the award to Ms. Gass. And by the time she got around to it, a year and 4 months later, in September of 2011, there was $40,000 and change left in that account. So her actual loss was about $67,000. All of that said, we are not challenging the judgment that was entered in favor of Ms. Gass, other than to point out the fact that these judgments were never recorded against my client's homestead, and so never attached to my client's homestead. So let's get down to the real issues here. First of all, contrary to the assertion by counsel, in a declaratory judgment proceeding, like the one that was before this court, the court's authority to act is limited to defining the legal relations, status, and situations of the parties. It cannot do affirmative relief in the context of a declaratory judgment proceeding. Does not have that authority, and the case law is very clear about that. It can simply declare relations. In our case, the court determined as a matter of law on motions for summary judgment that neither of the statutory exceptions to the homestead exemption laws that were being alleged by the plaintiff.
If you could just remind me, what is the case that you think is most important in terms of establishing the point that you're just trying to make, which is that in a declaratory judgment action, you can't provide relief?
Yes. Okay. Well, those are in my brief.
What do you think is the most important case that really we would have to distinguish in order to rule against you?
As far as whether the court had the authority to go on with that? Well, I think that
that it went beyond what it can do in a declaratory judgment action.
Well, for example, you have the Bainbridge Citizens case at 147 Marsh Ave.
Okay.
And you also have the City of Tacoma versus City of Bonnie Lake case, which is a Supreme Court case.
All right. Thank you.
Yes. So the point is that after the court found as a matter of law that there was neither a vendor's lien here nor an oilty lien, that was it. That's where things should have stopped. The court certainly didn't have authority to go beyond that. And indeed, it's wild, because if you look at page 14 of their brief, they assert, well, they're puzzled about this whole question because they're saying the trial court's decision on summary judgment was based on unjust enrichment, something that had never been alleged, and not on any theory of implied, equitable, constructive, or express terms. Well, the court doesn't have authority to do that in a context of a declaratory judgment proceeding.
But wasn't the complaint in the declaratory judgment action was precisely to declare that she was entitled to this money, notwithstanding your claim of homestead?
Well, that's right.
So the court gets to decide that. And the court decides that, yes, she was, notwithstanding your claim of homestead, because equitably she's entitled to that money, even regardless of vendor's liens or anything like that.
Well, first of all, as I said, my argument is two-pronged.
Because of Webster versus Roderick, because your client was using, trying to use the homestead statutes as a sword rather than as a shield.
No. Let me tell you why the court, okay, that gets to the second point. First of all, the court didn't have the ability to do that in a declaratory judgment proceeding, but second of all, this analysis is wrong. Webster versus Roderick is about a vendor's lien, because the funds that were fraudulently taken or whatever was wrong were used to buy and improve the real property. Okay? That wasn't our case. The judge found as a matter of law that there was no vendor's lien here.
So you're saying
and no appeal has been taken from that rule.
Narrowly and confine it to its facts.
If you look at the Christensen case, for example.
Yes, which, I mean, that is your argument, right? Read Webster versus Roderick narrowly and confine it to its facts.
Well, I don't think it's only that. I think you also need to look at the city of Algona versus Sharp, and you also need to look at the N. Ray Cunningham case. The city of Algona versus Sharp says the homestead statute does not make homestead exempt from taxation, but rather prevents a forced sale to satisfy a lien. The homestead laws are to be liberally construed in favor of the debtor. And you go on and you look at the bankruptcy case I cited, N. Ray Cunningham, and they say, based on the cases of Algona versus Sharp and Pinebrook Homeowners Association, this court should not read into the homestead statute any exceptions that are not contained in the statutory list. Under the constitutional grant of the homestead exemption, it says only the legislature can make exceptions.
So you
and those are to be narrowly construed.
Webster versus Roderick should be overruled then.
No, not at all.
Webster
versus Roderick is right on its facts. Namely, that was a vendor's lien case. The funds had been used to purchase and improve the property upon which the judgment debtor was asserting a homestead. That's a perfectly appropriate case.
But
all the cases say that that's appropriate.
Exception. Is that in the homestead statute?
I'm sorry.
Is there a vendor's lien exception in the homestead statute?
Yes. And that was alleged by the plaintiff below. The court determined as a matter of law that vendor's lien was not a, that they did not have a vendor's lien. Also, the court determined below, as a matter of law, they did not have an OLT lien, and neither of those rulings were appealed. Those are the law of this case. And the court doesn't have the authority after that, particularly in the context of a declaratory judgment proceeding, to say, okay, well, we're going to go ahead and attach exempt funds, even though there's no exception to the homestead exemption statute. The court can't do that. These are constitutionally protected funds. Where there are only exceptions that are narrowly drawn by the legislature. And as the court states in the Cunningham case that I cited, when the legislature is needed to make exceptions, it's done so.
You're eating into your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Bill Hollowell. I represent the respondent, Nancy Gass. There are two cases that should control the outcome. One you've just talked about, Webster versus Roderick, and the other one is the Christensen versus Christgard case. The first, the Supreme Court created a judicial exception to the application of the homestead exemption. That has been in existence since 1964. It said, if you get funds by theft or embezzlement and use them in that case to purchase real property, that property will not benefit from the homestead exemption. In Christgard, it was basically the same thing. This court applied Webster versus Roderick to a similar case where funds had been obtained by fraud and were applied to the purchase and improvement, presumptively, of real property, and the homestead exemption didn't apply there either. If you go back and look at Webster versus Roderick, the nexus between the bad act, the theft, the embezzlement, and the real property, That to me seems to be kind of the crucial point of this exception. In Webster, it was a clear purchase of property. But in the tracing, they knew that the thefts occurred over a period of several years, and they knew that during that period of time, the defendants had acquired and improved real property. They weren't able to show a nexus between the theft and the property, so they presumed it. It's natural to assume that money stolen during this period of time was used in whole or in part to improve real property. The same thing was done in Christgard, too. There was no ability to trace. All they knew was the guy had got money by, the defendant had gotten money by fraud and had subsequently gotten some real property. It was not traceable directly to it. In this case, it is. There was a mortgage paid with stolen money for 4 years. If nothing else connects this case to the real estate, that does it. We know from the divorce there was a mortgage on the property which he was ordered to pay and did pay. We know from the title report when the property sold, the mortgage was current. During that period of time, some 4 years, I'm sorry.
How does a title report show you whether a mortgage is current or not?
It shows you if there's any foreclosures going on the mortgage.
Okay, well, you can.
There were none.
A delinquent mortgage for which no foreclosure action has been taken yet.
I will accept that. If the mortgage had been delinquent for 4 years and no enforcement proceeding had been instituted to foreclose, there would have been nothing on the title report.
It seems that their argument doesn't go so much to me as Homestead as the remedy here, where the court sort of on its own creates this remedy. If you thought there should have been a trust, you could have pled it or asked for it, yet the court did this kind of on its own.
We asked the court for equitable relief, such other and further relief in law and equity as the court deems appropriate. Now, recently, the Court of Appeals approved that language in a non-equity situation where loss of consortium damages were awarded but never pleaded in a bench trial.
How did this come up in the context of this case? You pled, you asked for relief, you asked for declaratory relief. The court came to the conclusion that notwithstanding the claim of Homestead, there should be some. The court declared that she was entitled to some relief. Now, how did the idea that the relief should be constructive trust come up? I take it that was not what you initially argued for.
That was in the summary judgment brief we filed with the trial court. That was our first argument. Was the first argument we made is you should impose a constructive trust.
All right, okay.
And we listed the Webster and Christensen and made the argument that I kind of just made here.
So this argument that the court came up with at sua sponte is not accurate?
No. I had asked for it.
Okay.
I lost a couple of issues on equitable liens or what, I can't remember, whatever. But I won that one. So I had asked for it. It was in my brief. I admit, Your Honor, that the evidence of actual mortgage payments is not clear and unequivocal. It's circumstantial, just like the evidence that the money embezzled in Roderick and the money obtained by fraud in Christensen, that it was used to improve or purchase real property, is equally a little, it's not absolutely clear. The court basically said the money was stolen during this period of time.
Counsel,
they got real estate.
Are you making a distinction between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence?
Pardon me? Am I?
Is that the distinction?
Yes.
And in each
exactly.
case, we have circumstantial evidence.
Yes.
And we generally have an instruction we give juries that carries the same weight as direct evidence.
Yes. And it was circumstantial evidence that the money was used to improve real property in both Webster versus Roderick and in the Christensen versus Christgard. There was no direct evidence that it was done. But here, the evidence is even more direct. It may be circumstantial, but it's direct circumstantial because the mortgage was paid. The mortgage, according to the divorce papers and to the title report, was taken out in 2002. Was $100,000. When the property sold recently, the mortgage balance was $50,000, and there's no record anywhere that there were any defaults or foreclosures. He was making the mortgage payment, and he says, and his counsel says in every brief that he's filed, that because of his illness, he was having trouble making his living expenses and thus had to take my client's money to do that. He admits taking it. He admits using it for his living expenses, and one of those living expenses was inevitably a mortgage. That ties this case, if nothing else does, if the divorce case doesn't do it, then that ties this case to that real estate. And
are
that
you objecting to the trial court's conclusion that it wasn't a vendor's lien? Do you think the court was wrong in coming to that conclusion?
Not really, I don't. I suppose I should, but I don't. A lien implies to me security against to ensure some future behavior. or performance of some future duty. It's a lien. If you don't do this, then we have a lien and we will take that. When the judgment of when the decree of divorce was entered in this case, he owned the property, she owned those accounts. The court said, I award that to you. It didn't depend on him to do anything. Now, there was some fooling around with Fidelity. They needed this and they needed that, and they were reluctant to put the account in her name and so forth. Ideally, a certified copy of that decree and a strong letter from a lawyer. So either transfer that account or tell us where your registered agent is for purpose of service of process, because the court said it's hers. Give it to her. Well, that didn't happen, and there was some delay, and during the delay, he suddenly decided he needed the money. And he used that money not to purchase, but to keep real estate. Now, the other nexus to the property, of course, is the divorce case. A 50-50 division could not be any clearer. He got the property, she got the cash. He kept the property and then took the cash. If nothing else in this case, courts must and I'm sure do recognize a trial court's ability to enforce a divorce decree, despite all the machinations and twisting and bobbing and weaving that recalcitrant husbands sometimes engage in. So I think there's a clear nexus. Webster is controlling. Christensen is controlling. The cautions in Christensen are valid. They said Christensen and Webster don't apply in every case of wrongdoing, only in cases involving, what was the language, intentional culpability. If there is intentional culpability in getting the ill-gotten gain in the funds, then those cases apply. There was clearly intentional culpability in this case. Now, he claims he was driven to it by illness. His doctor says he began having illnesses in the fall of 2010. In January of 2010, and this is a record of proceedings at 370, he took $10,000 out of the Fidelity account. In March, he took $24,000, and April, $31,000. This is while restraining orders were in existence. After the one in April was after the arbitrator's decision, or the CR2A agreement. He took another $26,000 in June, and after the decree was entered, he took another $109,000. And that year, when his doctor says he was sick, he also earned $111,000 from Microsoft. That, with the $200,000 he took from that account, he had an income that year of over $300,000. He had a modest mortgage on a small home that only sold for $260,000 recently. The assets that were reported in the divorce, a modest car for each one. There's no condo in Maui, there's no boats, there's no planes, there's no pleasure craft. All he had were...
I'm going to give you 3 minutes.
Thank you. Let me just make a few points. First of all, you can't ask for relief that you've never asked for in your complaint for the first time in a motion for summary judgment. I don't know if he asked for it or not in the motion for summary judgment. In any case, you can't ask for it for the first time there.
But the action was consolidated with the dissolution action by
no.
the trial court.
Well, but yes, it was. That's true, it was.
So isn't there a certain equitable aspect to it then?
Well, there may be equitable aspect, but let me just get on to some other points. Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, the point is because the declaratory judgment was done in the declaratory judgment action. The point is, here's the thing. We agree, and this is what Webster versus Roderick holds. If funds are used to purchase or improve real property, then that creates a vendor's lien, and that's an exception to the Homestead Statute. The problem with Mr. Howell's argument is that he's now trying to relitigate that issue up here. The court ruled against him as a matter of law in the court below, and he did not appeal that decision. Therefore, this court is bound by that finding. He can't just suddenly raise it now when he didn't appeal it.
In the context of the divorce, is there any argument that what your client did is remotely fair?
We agree that my client engaged in wrongful conduct, but I dare say, Your Honor, that in every case where there is a judgment entered against a judgment debtor, The judgment creditor feels that something the judgment debtor did was unfair.
But you're in a kind of a unique situation in a family law case. That isn't simply a judgment. It's a division of assets.
Well, the Baker case makes it clear that judgments that are awarded in favor of wives don't just cut through the homestead exemption. You have to meet this very narrow statutory exceptions that have been set by the legislature. That's it. Otherwise, these funds are constitutionally protected. Constitutional. And only the legislature can draw exceptions. Now, I want to make a few other points about what
the two cases that counsel relies
yes.
on, he asserts that the court created an exception.
No.
You disagree?
I disagree. In fact, Webster versus Rockdale is a vendor's lien case, and so is Christensen. And
Webster purport to be creating an exception, or did it identify language in the statute that it was relying on?
Yes. In fact, in the Christensen case at page 632-631, the court says, we do not read language in Webster versus Roderick and authorities there cited to support exemption of property from the protections of RCW 6.12.090 whenever the purchase funds were somehow wrongfully acquired. In fact, they go even further. They say unless you can show they make it even narrower. Now in Webster versus Roderick, the funds that were used to purchase that property were funds that had been wrongfully taken from the defendant. It was like a vendor's lien. In other words, I think the buyer gave him money and he put it down and then he didn't give it back. The point is here, there's no evidence. Let me just finish if I can. Yes, sir, thank you. There's no evidence here that any of the money, as he pointed out, my client had other financial resources. There's no showing here that any of the money that my client wrongfully took from Ms. Gass, which we acknowledge, was used to purchase or improve the home. Again,
used up your time.
Yeah, he argued that case below. He didn't appeal it. He's bound by that decision.